Dr. Rabinowitz, how are you?
Hi, Pat. How you doing?
Very good. Very good. Let's get started here. We're going to talk about an interesting topic today, and I gave you a little promo before. We're going to be talking to Dr. Mark Rabinowitz for 15, 20 minutes, however long it goes. And he's in Southampton. Prevention First Healthcare. It's a revolutionary practice. Focuses on wellness. There you go. Proactive wellness. No wait times. There you go. I love that one. And patients have access to his personal cell phone. But aside from all that, he's a nationally recognized physician, noted healthcare authority, and I think he's a great guy. So stay tuned, and we'll talk about you. Now, what are we going to talk about today? The importance of annual physicals. Is that for everybody?
I think so.
Young kids, old people, what?
The Wall Street Journal had an article that questioned this, and they looked at one of the architects of the Affordable Care Act, who said that the annual physical is basically worthless, and they will quote some study that they may have done. And I could not take more exception to it. Now, to the defense of the Wall Street Journal, they went and interviewed doctors in academic medicine or internists like myself, mm-hmm. who felt exactly the way that I did. And what they were able to do is come up with examples, many examples of how a asymptomatic person, somebody that doesn't just comes in for a routine checkup, not complaining of anything, had undiagnosed medical problems where the physician was able to identify and save their life. And I personally do this all day long. And what concerns me is that people are sitting at home, and if they see it on the computer, they think it's the truth. If they see it comes from an architect of the Affordable Care Act, then it must be correct. And if this academician is quoting whatever study he wants to quote, well, that must be true. Mm-hmm. And I always like to quote my wife when I say, who's an educator, she says, you know, there's policies and procedures, but then there's common sense. And my belief is that what's missing in the American healthcare experience is the annual physical. It's one of the most important things when a doctor and a patient can sit down when the patient's not ill. Mm-hmm. You have to remember, when a person comes to a doctor with an illness, their concern is, why am I ill? And the doctor needs to focus on that. And the problem is, in American medicine, the average visit with a family doctor is anywhere from 6 to 10 minutes, with an internist is 10 minutes. And if somebody's, that's very, not very much time. I use the analogy of your car. Would you ever take your car to the mechanic because there's smoke from under the hood, or it makes a noise, or it doesn't start, or it's not running properly, and tell him, listen, you have 10 minutes to figure this out and fix it? They would laugh at you. They would throw you out and say, that's not possible. So why do you think, with a human being, with a human life, it becomes acceptable to only allow 7 to 10 minutes and then expect that a doctor should figure out something as complex as the human body? It's crazy. And then what happens is, what these people don't tell the American public is that the United States has the highest mortality in the industrialized world. We come in dead last for industrialized countries on how long we live. And if you compare our healthcare system to, example, the French healthcare system, in order to get your health insurance from the government, you have to report to a doctor for an annual checkup. It's a must, or your insurance is invalid.
Now, let me tell you about this thing. All right. I know a person, maybe even more than one, that, what is that test that they give men for, is it PSA for prostate?
Correct.
How about this? This is exactly what you're talking about. Someone had that test, absolutely no symptoms, and they found it,
Pat, there's something called
not one symptom.
Forgive me for interrupting you.
No, go ahead.
And it's a group of 16 people. It's a government-based and government-funded institution. And I think their bias is to look to save money by not doing tests. And what they do is they put out data and say, well, most men who have an elevated PSA will go on to have a normal biopsy. My contention is most mammograms are actually normal. Most, you know,
yes.
Most of the blood work that we order on people actually comes back within range. But that's not the point. The point is, you're trying to find a disease, particularly a cancer, at its earliest stages, when it's most treatable. So this is what I'm telling you is just anecdotal, but within the last 6 months, I've diagnosed 4 men with prostate cancer, 3 of which were aggressive and needed radical surgery to save their lives.
Mm-hmm.
One of them was another physician, and he and I sat there and debated the literature. And I said, listen, I don't know a urologist in practice that wouldn't order a PSA or a good internist or family doctor.
Mm-hmm.
It's become standard. It's what we do. And in this man's instance, it truly did save his life, as it did for the other three.
Mm-hmm.
Yet you could take the stance, well, look, I believe what the government tells me, and the government's one agency says not to do this, and it's no point to it. And I, you know, would have committed these 4 men to not just dying, but suffering. So I think people need to take a very, very close look at this and say to themselves, you know, Is this right? And I think it comes down to a doctor-patient relationship.
Mm-hmm.
I think the government discounts that. I got off the phone with somebody earlier today, and I called her about, you know, she has a reasonably complex problem she came to me for, and I asked her multiple other questions, and I asked her how she was feeling. She said to me, you know, doctor, I feel so much better after I've seen you. I now have a focus as to how to approach this problem,
mm-hmm.
how we're going to go through with it. And the other problems that she came for, she said, really haven't bothered me. She goes, I just feel so much better after having seen you. And I don't think that you can put a dollar value on that. And I don't
mm-hmm.
think that you can, can study that or put a number to that. And I think that what our government continually does is to just try and discount this doctor-patient relationship and say, according to this guy Ezekiel, go to a pharmacy and have your blood pressure checked. I mean, I don't know about you, but I go to the pharmacy and I see children playing on those machines. I would hardly call that an accurate medical instrument.
No, no. Now, this is kind of interesting. You sort of sound like an old-fashioned doctor.
Correct.
Now, I remember, I remember when doctors came to your house.
I still do.
You do?
Yes.
Wow. Well, why did that stop? Because there are so many patients? I guess probably.
I'll tell you, it didn't completely stop. I do it, my partner does it, but our practice is smaller and it's different. It's designed.
Yeah.
And that's a schedule thing. I mean, I do make my emergency calls sometimes. But what sort of happened, I think we've touched on this before, is that if you go back 30, 35, 40 years, you went to a doctor. You paid the doctor cash for your visit. Generally, I mean, people weren't using credit cards that much back then. The fees were reasonable. The doctor's overhead was much less. Generally, they may have no receptionists, maybe one person. Malpractice insurance
mm-hmm.
rates were low. You didn't need expensive computers or software so that you could communicate with insurance companies and the government. So overhead was low. And then what happened was when Medicare started to say, well, listen, if you want to participate with us, we're going to take control of paying you. And not to say they
mm-hmm.
didn't pay fairly. I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying when they took control of that and then they had the ability to dial the number down, and then the insurance company said, well, if these doctors are going to put up with that, well, we'll take advantage of them too. And then we're going to decide what they earn, and then we'll come up with this HMO model. And all of a sudden, in order for the physician to maintain whatever his income was, he has to see more patients and more patients. And then there's more paperwork and computers and more bureaucracy
mm-hmm.
and more delays. And so you now have people running like chickens without their heads off. And then people say, well, the hell with it. Well, why don't we just go and sell our practice? We'll go to work for somebody and let them worry about it.
Mm-hmm.
But now you have a boss, and then they attach even more overhead because they have more levels of administration
mm-hmm.
and more layers, and so on and so on and so on. And that's why you end up waiting a week to see the doctor. It's actually faster to see a private doctor, see a physician in Great Britain than it is in the United States by about 4 days. And the average wait time in the United States is about something like 68 minutes to see a physician. And you're going to get 6 to 10 minutes. If you can even get a physician, you may end up with a physician extender.
What do you mean by that?
Either a nurse practitioner.
A nurse practitioner or something, yeah.
And what choice does somebody that's sick has? They want to see someone. Now, I mean, not to say they may not do a decent job, but I will tell you, from having once been in an enormously busy practice, there is a loss of control. That you may say, listen, don't let that patient go out the door until you speak with me, but that nurse practitioner's got to, they have to see four or five patients an hour. They can't stop and do that all the time. And things, I will tell you, things can get lost, missed, not communicated. It's not a good healthcare experience, and the statistics in this case absolutely bear me out.
Well, you know, I want to ask you about the annual checkup. What happens during an annual checkup? What tests do you have?
There's two ways to do the annual checkup. Under the Affordable Care Act, they realized that, remember, this is in the Affordable Care Act, and it's covered by insurance companies now.
Right.
People should come in once a year because they do see the value of it. And I guess in a traditional sense, if it's based on, you know, 6 to 10 minutes with the doctor, doctor takes a blood pressure, does an examination, heart, listens to the heart and lungs, you know, feels the abdomen, looks in the ears and mouth. If it's a man, rectal exam. Probably if it's a woman, would get deferred to a gynecologist. And, you know, your instructions would be, it's sort of all age dependent, but an adult over 50, if it's a woman, to make sure that her mammograms are being done, that she gets to the gynecologist and they have a colonoscopy. For a man, a rectal exam and a colonoscopy. And if they were overweight, they would be told to diet, exercise, and lose weight. If it's a woman, go get a mammogram. And if they're older, maybe 65, get a bone density test. And, you know, routine bloods, and that would be pretty much it. Some people think that just the blood work and the EKG is the annual physical. Now, remember, once again, what's the starting point? 34th worst mortality in the world. So we don't live as long as the people in all the other industrialized country, and we're tied for Serbia. So then what happened is...
Now, wait, isn't that odd? Why is that?
Well, I think a lot of it is you don't really get real preventative care in this country.
Yeah.
And the contrast is when people began to notice this and said, this is before a preventative physical was even covered, they would say, well, people really need more time with the doctor, and since doctors won't be compensated for, say, per time, or for doing annual physicals, the movement began, and the misnomer was they used the word concierge medicine or boutique medicine or container medicine, but it's really preventative medicine. So people can come in for an hour and a half or more, and you go through an extensive family history. So let me just give you some examples of what that means. A 63 or 4-year-old patient who colonoscopy was 7 or 8 years ago, comes in, and I'm taking his family history, as I do every single year, to find out, tell me about your sister Mary, because I have to write down everybody's name and get all their information. Has anything happened to her? Any colon cancer, breast cancer, ovarian cancer, diabetes, or stroke? He says, oh, you know what? Glad you reminded me. I forgot to tell you. She had colon cancer. Really? Well, now what happens is, if you have a first-degree family member with colon carcinoma, if it's your first degree relative, you now need a colonoscopy every 5 years, not every 10 years. So I picked up the phone, I called down to one of my former professors who's at Jefferson, and lo and behold, this gentleman actually did have a tumor. Now, had he have just stayed with the routine screening tests, who knows, that could have spread to his liver, could have killed him. You know, that could have ended his life, but I saved his life, because I took the time to ask the right questions. Now, people will tell you, well, they could have filled out a form. Maybe, but who's going to review the form? And how much time does this all take? There was something you had touched on, I was impressed that you knew about this, where the Journal of American Medical Association came out and said, you know, doctors don't do a depression analysis. Now, I do a depression analysis on every single patient, and when I started to practice this way a number of years ago, I called leading psychiatrists, and I said, what is the best screening test that I should use? And they said, Mark, use the Sung depression analysis. So I sit with patients, and I give them a 20-question test for depression, and I will tell you, Pat, I have picked up people that have thought about suicide. I've got immediate psychiatric intervention from my office, occasionally admission to a hospital. I have had the unfortunate circumstance of having a patient that did commit suicide. In spite of immediate psychiatric care, unfortunately, we're not God and we can't save every patient. But the point is that if you don't ask the question, how are you ever going to get the answer? And often what you find is people will say, doctor, you know, I'm glad you asked me that. I've been meaning to talk to you about this. I've been horribly depressed. I have a problem with my job, my children, my wife, or I don't even know what's bothering me. So, but if you don't ever take the time to ask this, and all you've become is a repair shop for broken people, you just keep fixing broken people. But what about all the other people that you can help?
I think that's a great thing. It really is. You know, and a lot of people think that you're not depressed. Oh, well, they feel they're down in the dumps or something like that. But that's a thing. And people, you know, they eat or they drink or they do lots of things to combat it. But that doesn't usually come up in a doctor's office, really. Well, unless you're having some problem, I guess.
And people come in and they have the list. Doctor, I've got three things. I've got five things. I've got six things. Well, you really do have to focus on what's important to the patient. Now, you're also sitting there, and you have to review their medicines. You have to check the blood work, review the vaccinations, review the screening tests. So where in a traditional doctor visit that you're allowing that patient 6 to 10 minutes, by the way, that doctor's being interrupted. I don't know, you know, what your experience has been, but that phone's going to ring because that doctor may be getting calls from other physicians, from hospitals, from visiting nurses, from a nursing home. So it could become disjointed, and probably that doctor's maybe, you know, it could be half an hour to an hour behind in the schedule and rushing to get caught up.
Or you can have some doctors that don't go along with that, and they're so nice and friendly. And then you do wait an hour and a half to see them because they're talking to people.
That's okay.
No, it's not okay.
You know, I spoke to a younger...
It's not okay to wait long in a doctor's office.
Yeah, and he complained. He says, people walk out because I'm running behind. Because, but Mark, I'm spending so much time listening to them.
Yeah,
And, you know, there's no perfect world. There's no one right answer. But I think that with the advent of, you know, call it personalized preventative health care, where there are people that say, you know what, my life really has a lot of value, and for, you know, a little extra money, I mean a very small amount of extra money, I can have multiple preventative visits throughout the year to make sure that somebody's really on top of my health.
Well, I think it's a great idea. I think it's probably going to be the wave of the future, actually.
Well, Ben Carson did mention in the last debate.
Oh, did he? What did he say?
Oh, absolutely. And he said, you know, if things were structured differently in terms of reimbursements, there's plenty of government money for this.
Really? I wonder, you know, he should get a lot of points across if he's going to stay in the race, because he doesn't stand a chance of winning, but he has a lot of good points to make. And I just want to tell you this, as a little sidebar. There was a young girl, well, I was at this radio station a long time ago, just doing the news and everything, and she had seizures that were so bad they were life-threatening. Any minute she was going to die. She was 8 years old. She had half her brain removed, one hemisphere of her brain removed at Johns Hopkins. And now, and the residue that she had was she has a limp, and her left arm I don't think she can use, so obviously it was her right side. But anyway, she's a special teacher now. She works for the intermediate unit. She graduated college. She has a master's degree. She's getting married. She's had a pretty normal life, really. And guess who the surgeon was?
Ben Carson.
Yep.
Now, one of my very dear friends is the chief of pediatric anesthesiology at Hopkins. And he said he is the finest surgeon. And this man has been a 10 at Johns Hopkins. He said he is just the finest surgeon he has ever had the privilege to see.
Is that right? Well, he's certainly gifted that way, but I don't know. He's just a great man. It's too bad. It's too bad he's getting into politics.
My partner loves him. He's still voting for him.
Oh, well, I know. That's good. You vote your conscience. Now, why do you think, I'll ask you this question, and then we'll sort of wind down here a little bit. Why do annual checkups get a bad rap?
Well, I don't think they get a bad rap. I think what happens is the government is moving to something called evidence-based medicine.
Mm-hmm.
So what they do is they do research and studies, and then they come up with conclusions.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why they're saying, well, mammograms shouldn't start till 50. Well,
That's asinine.
I wonder how many of my own relatives would be dead if
mm-hmm.
they didn't have that screening mammogram at 35 or 40. Or how many of my patients would be deceased or suffering with metastatic cancer because we follow the recommendations that start them at 40. I mean, years ago, it used to be 35. And what about, I'll give you a great anecdote. And, they're looking at population studies and evidence-based studies. There's no perfect study. The only way to perfectly do a study is you take two groups of people. One is the placebo group or the control group, and the other is the intervention group,
mm-hmm.
and you watch them over a period of time. The problem is it's incredibly expensive to do that. It's hard to do it, and a lot of these studies are retrospective or what they call meta-analysis, where they're all done a little differently, and they throw all the data together.
Mm-hmm.
And they say, well, this must be the answer. So not that it's not interesting and not that you can't learn from it, and not that some of it doesn't provide some valuable information
mm-hmm.
that allows you to change the way you practice for the better, but it's not the be-all and end-all. I had somebody, I got a call on a Saturday, it's a large company. I take care of multiple people that work there.
Uh-huh.
And my wife said, who's calling you on Saturday? And one is with one of the executives that one of their other people, who I happen to know, uh-huh. came down with the breast carcinoma.
Uh-uh.
I was told they couldn't, the surgeon couldn't get to her for a month. And,
uh-uh.
you know, and what had actually happened was the woman is married, and she is of Ashkenazi Jewish origin,
mm-hmm.
although her husband isn't, and she has her husband's name. So it's not something where you would typically recognize that.
Mm-hmm.
And she had, her mother died of breast cancer, I believe, started in the mother's 20s.
Mm-hmm.
The mother's sister had the same thing.
Sure.
And there may have been one other female relative, maybe a grandmother. And when I called, and I was asking these questions, and she was, you know, telling me, and I said, well, when you go to a doctor, didn't someone ever ask you that? And she said, well, I don't, you know, no, they don't really take a full family history. No one ever asked me, just didn't strike me for whatever reason. And so what happened was nobody checked, and she had something called the BRCA1 mutation, which,
mm-hmm.
That's
a cancer thing.
This woman had a daughter.
Mm-hmm.
So the point is, if you're not going to ask the question, how are you ever going to come up with the answer? And so
mm-hmm.
be it, if somebody would have spent time with this woman and asked her, tell me about your mom. Oh, mom died at 23. Oh, my God, from what?
Mm-hmm.
Breast cancer. Whoa. Was she ever tested? Tell me about mom's sisters. You know, funny you ask. Mom's sister had it. So I don't.
Mm-hmm.
I honestly don't think there is ever going to be a substitute for just sitting down with a patient, giving them adequate time,
mm-hmm.
asking the right questions, and then treating people like their life is the only life that matters.
Mm-hmm. Well, every life matters. how about this? There are families that everybody has cancer. So if it is this gene thing, if it's a genetic thing, why can't they do something about that genetically? Why can't they, I don't know, is it possible? I don't know anything at all about that. But, I mean, is it possible to treat it that way, to get rid of it or to spot it very young in kids or something like that?
I had the privilege of attending a genomics conference at the in Bethesda, Maryland, at the National Institutes of Health.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really fascinating when you get to sit in a room with Nobel Prize winners
and
they think. And that's where they're moving to. And this genetic research is, I think, playing a huge role. I think we see it mostly in cancer, but also now the application into coronary artery disease and
uh-huh.
using monoclonal antibodies in private practice. So the point is they're being done. I think it actually started at Harvard. I think it was called Project Crimson.
Uh-huh.
One of their scientists, you know, when people go for blood work, Pat, they don't use every single drop of blood. Some of it gets saved or discarded, actually. And what
mm-hmm.
this doctor did was he had people sign a release that blood could be used to study their genes. and they began to amass.
Oh, that'd be
lots
interesting.
Lots and lots of people. And then that went into, I think it was the other Ivy League universities, and then the Veterans Administration. And this is called, these are called population genomic studies.
Uh-huh.
So what they're doing all over the world is acquiring data. They're looking at genes. And it's it's very, very complicated because you have to remember, it's not been that many years since the human genome has really been unraveled.
That's right.
It's probably less than 10 years. So, and, you know, they're applying computers. So I really do believe in time, people will be able to get a full genetic profile where major illnesses that people are prone to come down with will be detected. But there's so much that we don't know about how genes work. And there's the phenomenon of epigenetics. What's the effect of our environment on triggering that gene to actually begin to cause a problem?
Well, I think it's a fascinating subject, that whole business. You know, you can even see it in families if you... where you have so many American families that are mixed nationality groups. You know, and then diverse, like if you have a Mediterranean mother and an Irish father, as I do, two of the kids look like the mother, and two of the other ones look like the father, and the height is different, everything. And the two that look like the father had the same kind of issues that he had, and the two that look like the mother had the same thing that she has. And that is, it's phenomenal to me, it like the high blood pressure thing.
Oh, no, absolutely, and I think the and once again, this still speaks to the necessity for an annual physical because as technology continues to improve, and by the way, the cost of these tests continues to get to drop, becomes much less expensive.
Yeah,
but if you don't ever go, I'll give you a great example.
But everyone should have an annual physical.
Well, this is my bias. It's the way it's always been taught to us. Interesting, the history of the annual physical goes back to the early part of the 20th century when apparently the life insurance companies demanded people have an annual checkup before they would sell life insurance.
Mm-hmm.
And then it caught on with the private sector, with private physicians. But somebody came in for their checkup who had lost two relatives to pancreatic cancer. Now, most doctors will tell you that there is, it's not heritable. It's just sort of bad luck and that must circumstance. But I didn't let her sit, so I called the University of Pennsylvania to a doctor that writes his articles on the front page of the New England Journal. And we're blessed that we live in an area where you have major research centers. You have Penn, you have Jefferson, you have Drexel, and you have Temple, my alma mater, where this groundbreaking research is occurring. And I called this gentleman, and I said, let me run something by you. And he said, Mark, listen, we have newer tests. We've now figured out genes where there are families that pancreatic cancer runs in the families. And I was able to get that woman down there, and it changed the management. They were able to screen this woman differently. So, once again, this is somebody who had nothing wrong, but she came in for an hour and a half annual checkup, and I was able to take that family history, apply it, and get her in the right path.
Well, that's terrific, Doctor. I thank you so much.
Thank you. Have a nice day.
You're great. Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Mark. Okay, Dr. Mark, you can call 215-PREVENT. You can visit him online at 215prevent.com, and he also, you can meet with him for a free 30-minute consult, and I think it would be well worth your while.